This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, March 23rd, 2004. New networks of jihadists emerge faster than the U.S. and its allies can arrest or kill them. So writes Johanna McGeary in the March 29th edition of Time magazine. Counterterrorism experts believe, she continues, that a new, more elusive generation of extremists, apparently inspired by Al-Qaeda's ruthless vision, men like Jamal Zugan, 30 years old, a cell phone salesman arrested for the Madrid bombings, and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, 37 years old, the Jordanian suspected of orchestrating violence in Iraq, have taken up the banner. Barely recognizable, she continues, even to officials who make a living tracking terrorists. The new jihadists proved in Madrid that they can evade detection while they hatch their plots. And no one knows where they will strike next. Time magazine, this week. Today on Taking Aim, Operation Masquerade, Part 2. It's all one war now. Ralph?
It's all one war now is the theme that is orchestrated in Newsweek for the 29th of March. It's all one war now because the cancer of terrorism has become ubiquitous. It has metastasized, according to the authorities in the United States. It is everywhere. It is no longer Osama bin Laden. It is no longer Al-Qaeda. It is also the plethora of organizations that are so organized and so prevalent that there's no longer any ability to track them. As DEPCA was indicating last week, there are over 100,000 sleeper operatives in Europe, 45,000 in France, 10,000 in Great Britain, 25,000 in Italy, tens of thousands in Spain, in Germany, in Greece, in Poland. The scenario that is now being presented by the authorities is that of a ubiquitous, all-embracing terror apparatus that is so prevalent that it cannot be tracked. And yet the individuals who they are citing as responsible for the bombings in Madrid are people who they have had under their control and under their watch since the year 2000. As we documented last time, Yarkus and Zugam, who are the current fall people, the patsies for this event, were also so set up for the no less than 9/11 itself and the bombings in Casablanca, and yet in each instance they were not able to indict them for a lack of evidence and monitored them from every day thereafter.
It's World War IV, as former CIA Director James Woolsey had called it. And as you recall, on Taking Aim, we did an entire series on World War IV. And President Bush, on the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, gathered diplomats from 83 nations in the East Room of the White House. And he stated, quote, "There is no neutral ground in the fight between civilization and terror. There can be no separate peace with the terrorist enemy," end quote. A fight between civilization and terror around the world. This is the basis of the new militarization of the United States, where more than 50% of the discretionary income of the U.S. budget is devoted to war. Ralph?
In the Time magazine article, "Who is the Enemy Now?", there is an ominous conclusion. As it delineates, according to CIA Director George Tenet, other extremist groups have become the next wave of the terrorist threat. It makes them impossible to find and stop. Even in hindsight, there was no electronic chatter, no rumors, nothing but interrogations, nothing to hint of the attacks before the train bombers struck in Madrid. The amorphous nature of the plotter's network enables it to operate under the noses of intelligence and police. And that is why, Time magazine concludes, in the darkened warrens of the U.S. counterterrorism agencies, the pace is unrelenting. These officials are intensely worried that the Islamists emboldened by the Spanish vote have focused now on targeting the United States in the run-ups to the election. And indeed, they state, this summer's Democratic and Republican conventions in Boston and New York, officials warn, provide exactly the targets that al-Qaeda teaches its operatives to choose. The crush of VIPs, the chaos, the noise, the long hours, a security nightmare. And indeed, as U.S. officials point out, both conventions will be held above train stations. They are setting us up. They are testing the waters. They are sounding the alarm. They are preparing our public for massive attacks that will be the basis for canceling an election in 2004.
And, Ralph, throughout the media are articles that state how easy it is for these terrorist organizations to operate. But they always neglect to point out that the base of these terrorist organizations are the intelligence authorities themselves. For instance, Milt Bearden, who was a CIA operative, had worked with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan and was instrumental in the establishment of the Taliban al-Qaeda networks. This was during the U.S. opposition to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Now we
it
have
actually preceded that, Maya.
Oh, yes, you're right. I'm
because
sorry.
Because as Brzezinski set forth in his important book on the Grand Chessboard, the idea was to trap the bear, to entice the Soviet Union in, and they did that by setting up no less than Osama bin Laden and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar in the terror operations that were intended to destabilize the Central Asian republics and to create a wave of terror bombings and assassinations and attacks in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and
Kyrgyzstan.
Kyrgyzstan and the Soviet republics of the day, such that the Soviet Union was induced to send its troops into Afghanistan in the bear trap that Brzezinski prepared, the terror apparatus, the Central Intelligence Agency operations, which continue to this minute.
And the funding of the warlords weren't considered sufficient, and that's why they set up the terror apparatus. Newsday, March 15th, 2004. Cell phones jury-rigged to detonate bombs by Lou Dolinar. And this is an important article, and you can see it on globalsecurity.org. The reason I say it's important is because they're trying to promote that it is so easy to set up a terror network and to have bombs throughout the urban areas. It's not rocket science, says John Pike of globalsecurity.org, a Washington think tank. Cell phone detonators are pretty straightforward tradecraft. For instance, in looking at the Madrid bombing, where 10 exploded and 2 were found and detonated by bomb disposal experts, Global Security states that these are typical. The ringer of the phone was wired to 2 detonating caps, an operation that experts say is delicate and requires training, but can be accomplished with common tools available in any electronic store. The detonators, in turn, would set off 22 pounds of gelatinous dynamite. Packed around the explosives, continues the Newsday article, in the sports bag that concealed it were nails and screws designed to serve as shrapnel. More sophisticated phone bombs also incorporate timers, but in general, all a bomber needs do is dial or email the number and let it ring. According to Pike of Global Security, many remote bombs aimed at U.S. troops in Iraq also have been triggered by cell phones. And a cell phone was used in the cafeteria bombing at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, as well as in the Bali bombings, October 2002, that killed 202 people. And that also used the cell phone detonator. So we have here the contention by the people who analyze global security, such as John Pike, and promoted throughout the press that the mechanisms of the bombs are available in your local electronics store and are part of the new global terror network. Ralph.
The problem with this scenario is that it doesn't meet the physical evidence. The fact of the matter is that the detonations of these 10 bombs that were set under the trains were set such as to blow the floor from underneath such that it penetrated the roof and emerged above the roof line itself. That's not done by cell phones. That's done by charges placed underneath the carriages of the train. The physical evidence is clear. This was a sophisticated intelligence and military operation that required not just prolonged access to the trains in their stations, but the capacity to set the charges underneath the carriages of each individual train. Did the CIA warn about the Spanish 311 on March 1st? Asks Nico Haupt in the Portland Independent Media Center. March 13th is the article, and it's instructive. On February 29th, a newspaper that is prominent, perhaps the most prominent newspaper in Madrid, El País, claimed that September 11th, 2001, was finalized in the Spanish Mediterranean port of Tarragona. And El País quotes informed U.S. intelligence sources. Well, what are these intelligence sources, and why are they suddenly on February 29th in El País maintaining that 9/11 was finalized in Spain? Was this indeed a warm-up for the next attack within Spain itself? The question is posed. The Spanish paper El País claims that at the same time as their article on February 29th about the information concerning 9/11, that this was corroborated by interrogation of Bin Ramzi al-Shaibiya, Bin al-Shib, who is in U.S. custody, and it is claimed that this was passed to the Spanish intelligence services by its U.S. counterparts. What's interesting about this is that no one has ever seen Ramzi Bin al-Shib except the Central Intelligence Agency. The White House refused to allow him to testify for the German 9/11 trials, which resulted in their inability to bring in indictments. And indeed, about suspects that are now being attributed to al-Qaeda, al-Bughani, Mazoudi, and Muhammad al-Mutasaddiq, the courts acquitted them. The courts in Germany acquitted them. Bin Ashib's supposed evidence was not available because the U.S. would not allow it to be presented. A request by the Spanish judge, Guillermo Ruiz Polanco, to hear more from Bin Ashib about the Tarragona meeting, where supposedly 9/11 in the United States 2001 was finalized, was denied as well. Further instructive evidence of what's going on here. The so-called 20th hijacker, Zacharias Massawi, his trial was blocked when Judge Brinkema stated he was waiting for statements from Ramzi Bin al-Shib, and the White House refused to provide it. In other words, their informant is their collaborator, he is their instrument, and he is not allowed to be brought into evidence because it would expose the intelligence connections of these operations. Who then is orchestrating these attacks? Ask Nico Haupt, which plays into the mindset of the military and the oil globalists and serves a long-standing U.S. plan for the Middle East and Central Asia. And indeed, why would al-Qaeda, of all organizations, carry out a terror operation in Madrid on the eve of an election that all assumed would consolidate control by Aznar and the Spanish authorities who were maintaining their alliance with the United States? Who had an interest, the question is posed, to carry out such a terror attack in Madrid on the working assumption that it would in fact cause a panic amongst the population and the re-election of a government, notwithstanding the fact that 90% of the population in Spain opposed the war in Iraq. The article continues with instructive evidence. What is the evidence that is being now marshaled against al-Qaeda with respect to Madrid? Alcalá de Henares, a town in East Madrid, where the investigators claim the bombs may have been put on board the trains. That's the same city in which the discovery of a truck with 7 detonators and a convenient cassette recording of verses of the Quran was conveniently found. The question is posed, did the so-called terrorists have no time to remove the truck? The instructive article continues. Why would al-Qaeda contact al-Quds al-Arabic, which is run by Abd al-Bari Atwan, who is a loyalist of Saddam Hussein, hardly an ally of al-Qaeda? Abu Hafs al-Masri, the so-called affiliated group of al-Qaeda, which is said to have planted car bombs in the Marriott Hotel in Jakarta, which is said to have carried out attacks in Istanbul on synagogues, which is said to have carried out a series of attacks in Turkey and Al-Qaeda and Jakarta as well, is now being claimed to be a fictive organization as well. What lies behind this? And why is it that El País is orchestrating on February 29th a scenario to prepare people for an attack in Spain? Let's look more carefully at El País and the prior knowledge that is indicated by their reports. One of their primary contributors and responsible for this disinformation is Marco C. Vincenzino, a lawyer who was admitted to the New York State Bar. He has been contributing to Fox News, Al Jazeera, Dubai Television, Saudi TV, and Kuwait TV, orchestrating the theme that Al-Qaeda is preparing massive attacks, specifically in Spain. He is also a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations and in charge of research projects for security policy and civil-military relations in Latin America. The co-founder and board member, along with Mr. Vincenzino, is Diego Hidalgo on El País. He is founding director and senior fellow of the Gorbachev Foundation of North America, together with John Deutsch, Deputy Secretary of Defense and former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. It's interesting to note that Deutsch is not only a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, but is closely associated with the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, Peter G. Peterson of Blackstone Group, which on October 17, 2000, purchased the participating mortgage secured by No. 7 World Trade Center, the building that collapsed under undisclosed circumstances on September 11th, never having been hit by a plane, at 5:25 p.m. on September 11th. What we are looking at here is we piece together the character of El País and the disinformation that was prepared and the February 29th anticipation of the attacks in Madrid and the association of these with 9/11 and with Casablanca. This is the smoking gun exposure of the disinformation of an organ like El País for the intelligence apparatus itself, for who gains and who is motivated by the attacks on Madrid.
Ralph, if you look at the series of articles that have been appearing in the New York Times, you can see how flimsy is the evidence upon which the Spanish courts have been incarcerating the Moroccans and the Indians in Spain. And it doesn't make any sense. It's just on hearsay or circumstances, but there is no solid evidence. And in fact, the investigation will take 2 years. 2 years before any charges actually may be brought against these people. Meanwhile, the five suspects, the three Moroccans and the two Indian men, are being held without bail and in solitary confinement on the orders of Judge Juan del Olmo. And the rulings of the investigative magistrate, as I said before, for the judicial inquiry, could last up to 2 years before the suspects would be formally charged in a higher court. Meanwhile, all five men have denied any responsibility for the bombings, and all have said that they have no ties to a terrorist organization. Ties to a terrorist organization, collaborating with a terrorist organization, is one of the charges. And all of them said that they were asleep at home when the bombings took place on the morning of March 11th. Mr. Zugam and the other two Moroccans are accused of 190 murders because 12 of the victims remain unidentified and 1,400 attempted murders as well as belonging to a terrorist organization. According to Spanish officials, they claim that Zugam was an important link between the cell of Al-Qaeda in Spain and, as you mentioned, the militants that are aligned with the Moroccan Islamic Combat Group, GICM, which is blamed for the bombings in Casablanca last year. Of course, there has been no direct evidence that there is any relationship between Zugam and the group. nor, as the Spanish admit, there is no evidence that Zugam placed any of the 13 bombs that were left on the four trains. They say that he probably coordinated the provision of telephones and other supplies. But the only evidence they have for that is that the SIM card that was placed in one of the cell phones was tracked to his cell phone shop. How many cards and how many cell phones could have been purchased from that shop? They also claim that a tiny piece of plastic broken off from a cell phone from one of the unexploded bombs was recovered in his shop. And I ask you, how many weapons are known for the police to have dropped here in the United States and elsewhere? Certainly a little piece of plastic can be dropped by the investigators from a cell phone that they had in their control.
What we have to keep in mind, Maya, as you elucidate the absence of any significant evidence of any merit, is the fact that these individuals who are now being held responsible, the patsies indeed, are not people without a past history. We have been documenting, as we've stated in this show, these are the very individuals who El País has been stating were associated with the planning of 9/11 itself in the United States. An attempt was made to indict them at the time. Yarkas was stated to have been a roommate of Mohammed Atta in Hamburg, and indeed the Spanish counterpart of Mohammed Atta preparing 9/11, which El País says was finalized in the city of Tarragona. All of this was attempted to be brought into a trial in Spain. They couldn't convict them, but they kept them under close surveillance. Once again, with the Casablanca bombings, the same scenario. These are not novice people who they've just suddenly discovered. These are people who they've been monitoring on a nonstop basis since August 2000, according to El País. Now, listen,
Ralph, before you say that, I'd also like to mention that, in fact, the Spanish investigators had been recording the telephone conversations of Jamal Zugam, and they had an innocuous conversation recorded between Zugam and Imad Eddin Barakat Yarkas. Yarkas, who, as you mentioned, they were following.
So here we have it. Their operatives, who they are monitoring and controlling, are supposed to be responsible for something that they are being watched about every second of the day. But listen to Newsweek on the 29th of March. U.S. officials told Newsweek that a level of panic has broken out inside the United States government as a result of Madrid. U.S. officials, in whistling past the graveyard, insisted that the Spanish standoffishness was just the politics of the moment. What is the level of panic about? The level of panic is about the fact that the anticipated result of this planned state terror operation Masquerade in Madrid, would result in the consolidation of the puppet regime of Aznar in power in Spain. It was intended to panic people on the eve of the Spanish election. They did not anticipate, nobody anticipated, Debca, Newsweek, Time, the U.S. intelligence agencies themselves, all anticipated that the consequence of the bombing would be a massive victory for the Aznar government. They did not anticipate the revolt of the masses in Madrid, and that is what is responsible for the level of panic. And here is Newsweek making this clear. Washington has reason to fret. Though France and Germany and other nations have been cooperating on intelligence, Spain is not now alone in seeking to distance itself from the United States under popular pressure. South Korea's government last week refused to send troops to terror-torn Kirkuk in Iraq. Leery of its anti-American public may now react to casualties. Polish President Aleksander Kwasniewski, a tried-and-true ally, questioned Washington's credibility and told a group of French journalists he was taken for a ride on intelligence. After an urgent high-level phone call from the White House, Warsaw again clarified the statement and said that Kwasniewski had misspoken himself. It was not George Bush who had deceived him, we're informed by Newsweek. It was Saddam Hussein. After questions about how long he would keep the 2,400 troops in Iraq, the Polish leader reaffirmed that the soldiers would stay, notwithstanding his statement that they would be withdrawn, because he had spoken to George Bush. about the subject. We can only imagine the concrete boots that were promised this prime minister if he didn't reverse himself within hours of having publicly declared that his population no longer would tolerate the presence of Polish troops in Iraq. Here again, scorecard on the shadow war, Michael Hirsch in Newsweek. In the future, we will have to expect massive terrorist strikes to try to influence elections, said a senior European intelligence official who added ominously, the situation before the U.S. elections is very clearly a moment of opportunity, which I fear. The situation before the U.S. elections, once again Newsweek orchestrating the theme on March 29th. Back on the home front, Newsweek continues, Europeans are resisting Washington's efforts to get them to toughen up on permissive civil liberties laws. There's no Gitmo in Europe. U.S. officials are disturbed, notwithstanding what occurred in Madrid, by the inability of authorities in Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, and even Britain to hold terror suspects indeterminately without releasing them. And it goes on to state that part of the expected outcome of the bombing in Madrid was a massive repression across Europe on the lines of the Patriot Act that would result in thousands of people being swept up and creating both a panic and a terror and a climate of fear. Here is Dan Benjamin, the counterterrorism official from the Clinton White House. The Madrid strategy has backfired. The Madrid strategy has backfired. If more attacks occur, the European public could move closer to the U.S. view that fighting terror calls for warfare. If more attacks on a scale not seen before occur, the U.S. may obtain a result different than that of Madrid. One senior intelligence officer in a country that did not support the Iraq war told Newsweek, if Spain removes its troops, it would be disastrous, and this must be avoided. What does Newsweek continue to describe? A high chancellery official in Berlin agrees. Europe and the U.S. must be brought closer together. So what are we learning here? They tried it in Madrid. It backfired on them. The conclusion they draw? Up the ante. Even more massive attacks in Europe to panic the population, to stabilize the allies or the subordinate governments in Europe, and to prepare for the maintenance and escalation of troops in Iraq.
Ralph, that is why there was a captive audience session in the East Room on the anniversary when there were the 83 diplomats from 83 nations summoned to listen to President Bush. And that is why he stated clearly, there is no neutral ground. It is the warning from the United States that all the nations must stay together with the United States. And they have set upon this path of a war, be of civilization versus terror. If you look at the military base, the militarization of U.S. throughout the world, and an article that appeared on March 21st in the San Francisco Chronicle, also reproduced on globalsecurity.org, called After 9/11, U.S. Policy Built on World Bases. At the back of it, at the end of it, there is a listing of the U.S. troops around the globe, 350,000 U.S. troops stationed around the globe, from Bosnia and Kosovo, Georgia, Haiti, South Korea, Colombia, Yemen, Djibouti, Iraq, Afghanistan, Philippines, Qatar, Germany, Japan, Italy, and England are only a few. And on all of these bases, you have nuclear weapons bases and forward operating bases, communications interception all around the globe, stationed everywhere for control of resources, for control of the population. From Uzbekistan to Pakistan to Qatar and Djibouti, as I've mentioned before, places like these are called by the Pentagon lily pads. And that is why, to maintain this military industrial apparatus, they have to conjure up a fight as Bush says, a fight between civilization and terror. You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. If you missed part of our program, it's on our internet site, www.takingaim.info. Our program today, Operation Masquerade. It's all one war now. Ralph?
This is a theme that has been orchestrated in tandem, not just in Newsweek and Time magazine, but across the world. In the Newsweek article of March 22nd, "Terror's Next Stop Everywhere. Are we safer from attack? No. The threat is growing ever more diffuse, ever more hard to fight. The changing nature of terror and the groups who are targeting the innocent." And this article on the 22nd of March states that U.S. officials insist, and Zarqawi, they're referring to the supposed lieutenant of Osama bin Laden, is now a major terrorist leader in his own right, and that there is a 17-page terror memo that establishes that he is no longer operating under Osama bin Laden, but has established his own apparatus, and that this is only one of many. Indeed, it attributes the Zarqawi cell to be associated with the spiritual leader of a London mosque, which was supposedly a mosque attended by Zacharias Massawi, and that there are now dozens of groups. George Tenet told Congress, the Zarqawi Network, the Ansar al-Islam Network, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, it has morphed into dozens of groups, and there is no clue as to where they will strike next. Your Milt Bearden, as you cited, Maya, the CIA station chief in Pakistan, the terror threat is metastasized to the point where we haven't got a clue where they will pop up next, and they are everywhere. For Americans, Newsweek tells us the reality of the new shadow war hasn't hit home yet, but it will. Even though the millions who ride commuter trains are queasily aware of how easily Madrid would happen here, and that is now considered to be inevitable. Indeed, the Newsweek article states the steady growth of a global movement of infected by Al-Qaeda's radical agenda and infused by an anti-American sentiment is now everywhere and without restraint. Mullah Krekar lives openly in Norway. In Switzerland, the terror organizations are growing. September 11th hijacker Mohammed Atta once transited Zurich in connection with his visits to Spain to prepare 9/11. Now we have Switzerland and Spain as not just Hamburg and Florida for Mohammed Atta and his Spanish colleagues. Look at the way in which this is being orchestrated, brothers and sisters. They are telling us that it is everywhere, that it is untouchable, it is uncatchable, that it will lead to even more massive attacks than we have seen in Madrid and the United States, and that is inevitably next.
Well, Ralph, as Depke points out, it's not even based in the mosques anymore. It's in the cafes of Europe and in the social clubs of Europe. If you look at your neighbor, according to Depke, if you look at Time Magazine and Newsweek and all the vehicles of the bourgeois state, if you look at your neighbor, you don't know who your neighbor is, because the question is, who's next and who's involved? This brings me back once again to 10:25 a.m., the 2nd of August, 1980, when a powerful bomb exploded in the second-class waiting room at the Bologna, Italy, railway station. It was the height of the summer holiday season. The station was crowded with tourists and Italians who were headed for their holidays. 85 people were killed, 200 injured. It was considered one of the worst atrocities that was seen in Europe since the war. One of the seven of the victims were children under the age of 15, and one of them was a girl of 3. The judicial investigations, as we discussed last week, were barred from really discovering the truth by the Italian secret services. And but what was revealed over the years, and it took over 45 years between the end of World War II and the full revelations of what really was going on that led to the bombing in Bologna. And we come back to it again and again when we talk about Madrid, because the bombings that took place in Italy, from the Piazza Fontana bombing of 1969 through the Bologna railway station bombing and many bombings after that, were all part of a network that had been established by the Central Intelligence Agency, starting with Alan Dulles, the first head of the Central Intelligence Agency, and involving the security apparatus of country after country throughout Europe and notably in Italy. It was called the Strategy of Tension. The Strategy of Tension, much like today, the strategy against this global war on terror. And then the enemy was the Communist Party in Italy and in other countries throughout Europe. And today it is an more amorphous enemy, but still for the same purpose and the same purpose only, to maintain the capitalist state, to maintain and to use in that maintenance the large military industrial complex that, as I mentioned before, is taking over more than half of the discretionary income of the budget, the U.S. budget. And if you look in cities and states across the United States, the funding of the police apparatus, the security apparatus, which is depriving us of the funds to fund schools and other social services. Ralph?
Operation Gladio, intelligence operation over four decades, in fact, it goes back to 1948 in Italy, was an example of state terrorism directed from Washington from day one. At every conjuncture in Italy, CIA Director William Colby described in his memoirs how he was sent to Italy to run what was by far the CIA's largest covert program undertaken until then and indeed since. The man who was CIA director from 1973 to 1976 explained that his task was to prevent Italy from being taken over by communists or leftists in elections, and indeed to secure NATO bases and a NATO center of operation both in Rome and in Naples. Colby went on to state that the CIA began in the 1948 elections with the formation of an Office of Policy Coordination that gave them the capability to undertake covert and paramilitary operations across Italy. What are these paramilitary operations? According to Ray Klein, former deputy director of the CIA, the first number documents issued by the new National Security Council in 1947 included a top-secret report called the position of the United States with respect to Italy, and indeed it cites a cable by George Kennan, who is the director of the State Department's policy planning staff. It called for a series of covert military operations, we're talking about terror attacks, brothers and sisters, across Italy on a constant basis. The early phase of what was called right-wing terrorism, which lasted until 1974, was characterized by the tactic, and I'm quoting, of indiscriminate bombings directed against the public. Every one of these orchestrated by intelligence agencies in Italy run by the Central Intelligence Agencies. These included the total penetration of the Red Brigades with provocations and murders, including the murder of Aldo Moro. Indeed, Operation Gladio was something that the Central Intelligence Agency used for four decades to destabilize Italy through state terror, through terror bombings, through bombings that in fact blew up Bologna train station 24 years ago. On the 31st of October, going back further, 1974, General Vito Micheli, head of Italian military intelligence, was arrested on evidence that he was conspiring to overthrow the government with an armed insurrection to provide an excuse for military intervention This was an operation run by the United States.
Ralph, you have only two, as you mentioned with Colby, we also have Lawrence Eagleburger, who was the Assistant Secretary for Political Affairs in 1981. And he spoke to Il Tempo, the Italian newspaper, on May 1st, 1981. They published his an interview with him. He stated, "The United States, in both Republican and Democratic administrations, has been opposed to Communist Party participation in governments of our allies. We would like to see Communist influence in any Western European country reduced. That policy has been consistent and clear. It spans the post-war period. It is not under review." Now, he was being questioned about about the U.S. involvement in Italian politics and the U.S. attitude towards the Italian Communist Party. And if you look at Eagleburger's comments and you tie them in with Colby's and you tie them in with other revelations, you see that this crosses both Democratic Party and Republican Party lines. It is not just from one administration. As George Kennan, director of the State Department's policy planning staff, had written, he was under Reagan, he wrote a book called The CIA Under Reagan, Bush, and Casey. On 15 March 1947, Kennan wrote, he's quoted in this book by Ray Klein, the former deputy director of the CIA. Ray Klein wrote The CIA Under Reagan, Bush, and Casey. In March 1947, Kennan wrote, "As far as Europe is concerned, Italy is obviously the key point. If communists were to win an election there, where a whole it would change our whole position in the Mediterranean and possibly in Western Europe as well, and it would probably be undermined." So the stakes were very high, and the stakes were the direct involvement, including General Haig, with the Gladio apparatus. In 1969, a document for the Gladio apparatus was revealed in Italy to the Agenter Press, which is a Lisbon-based, that's Lisbon, Portugal agency, but it was sent from Italy to Portugal, and it spelled out what the strategy of Gladio. It was called Our Political Action, and it recommends the promotion of chaos throughout the structures of the Italian regime so as to undermine the economy. And they say they were leading to a strong, they wanted to create political tension and fear in the industrial world. Everything that you and I have been saying, particularly you, Ralph, over the years, when you talk about the strategy of terror, the involvement of Jean Kirkpatrick, of Benjamin Netanyahu, of George Bush, and so on.
Maya, a top secret memorandum of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, dated May 1952, and I'm now citing again from what became Operation Gladio, reveals the existence of a plan codenamed Demagnetize. The 1952 top secret memorandum of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, with its plan called Demagnetize, called for the establishment of terror organizations across Italy, for the staging of assassination, of bombings, of strikes, of kidnappings of prominent officials, all of these to be imputed to the left, to create not just chaos, but the conditions for a military coup and for neo-fascist control of the state through the remaining Mussolini operatives in the intelligence and military high echelons in Italy. That is the gravamen of the penetration of the Red Brigades with the kidnapping and murder of Aldo Moro. That is the meaning of the bombing of the train station in Bologna 24 years ago, and almost the model of what occurred in Madrid. That is the evidence of an ongoing state terror apparatus inseparable from the workings of corporate capitalism and the national security apparatus of the state. That is the real background, and that is the real means through which we can understand exactly what is unfolding in Europe.
Ralph, before we go on, I'd like lastly to mention that the actual training of these right-wing paramilitary squads and the people who infiltrated the Red Brigades, the infiltration was tracked back to the same training. They all received the same training at a secret NATO base near Capo Marigue on the west coast of Sardinia. And the base had been set up in 1963, and almost 4,000 people were trained there. The purpose was to organize their resistance and sabotage, and that's what they were trained in, the techniques, and it was most active between 1969 and 1975. And now this was an inaccessible NATO base, and they had to be flown in by military aircraft from an airport that's just outside of Rome. This was sophisticated operation. So when we look at Madrid and we look at the terror operations in Bali and elsewhere, we have to hearken back to what the United States and also the intelligence operations of the bourgeois state in countries throughout Europe were doing year after year in Italy, and that has been revealed piece by piece, little piece by piece, and seems to have been forgotten by people. You have to always remember, you have to always put it back together when we look at the events of the current moment.
Maya, who's next after Madrid, writes Debka, which is the Israeli and essentially the Mossad news service, on March 23rd, 2004. Who's next after Madrid? After detailing the claim that every major attack has been a coordinated effort of the Al-Qaeda apparatus, Debka states, the next target will be Italy, Britain, and the United States. And they proceed in this document to cite how Madrid is part of a closely coordinated plan to disrupt elections, that it was first now in Madrid and next to be in London, and after that the United States. And then in an article on the 20th, the Debka states, Bin Laden orchestrated the Madrid attacks in person. His success owes less to superior craft than to the laxness of U.S. and counter-terror authorities. And it proceeds to state that the intelligence apparatus, now, of course, of Osama bin Laden, notwithstanding the fact that the simultaneous contention is that the metastasizing of the, quote, terror apparatus has made it ubiquitous across Europe and the world. But here it is bin Laden himself who, according to Debka, has orchestrated the Madrid attacks in person. And then we have the Times News Network on Sunday, March 14th, after Madrid, London is next. Like Humpty Dumpty, U.S. and European stocks are having a great fall, and the article states that London is the inevitable next target, even as the Debka in Canada cites that Al-Qaeda is emerging as a coordinated operation for undertaking targets across Europe. And then in the United States, London, Rome, Berlin, New York, and Washington. This is not random reporting. This is a coordinated and orchestrated undertaking by the disinformation services of the terror state itself. Here we have Jason Benetto writing for the New Zealand Herald and citing the London Press on the 17th of March. Buses, nightclubs, and pubs in London are the targets for the next terror attack following the Madrid bombings, the head of the Metropolitan Police of London warned yesterday. Sir John Stevens, the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, stated, "It is an inevitability. It is an inevitability, the terror assault on the capital." His fears were echoed by Ken Livingstone, the mayor of London. "It will be miraculous if the capital escapes. The capital escapes the attacks." The senior police chief warned that the terrorists would not copy the tactics used in Madrid. He said, "We are not just talking about the tube and the rail system. We're talking about London in general. We're talking about buses, nightclubs, pubs, and raids. The scale of this is such that Scotland Yard is preparing exercises of emergency services all over Great Britain. In addition to the Met is recruiting the Metropolitan, which is the underground or the subway in London, hundreds of officers to anti-terrorist and special branches. The police and security services, Sir John stated, are working three times harder. It is an inevitability, he repeated, and the Prime Minister and Home Secretary repeated what Sir John Stevens stated. There is an inevitability to the attacks on London. Inevitable indeed, because we know that the organizers and the perpetrators of these crimes are the rulers themselves, the state terror that brought us 9/11, the state terror that is preparing the next wave in London and then in the United States. The same orchestration of disinformation that was in the Washington Post with the evidence that is being presented there for the inevitable cancellation of the elections in 2004, with the theme by Tommy Franks and the cigar aficionado about the cancellation of constitutional rights and of elections. All of this is being constantly orchestrated in the presses and the newspapers and the of the world through the mouths of the heads of police, the prime minister, the foreign minister, even the left socialist mayor of London, Ken Livingston, buying into the ruler scenario of the inevitability of the attacks. House panel prepares for catastrophic attacks, Associated Press reports on January 21st, 2004. It is disinformation. It is, in fact, the desperation of a capitalist ruling class under siege by a mass of people disaffected from its lies, from its preemptive wars, from its all-out assault on the gains of working people. It is a confrontation they only know how to respond to with the escalation of state terror, as they promise us on a daily basis.
And, Ralph, like with Gladio in Italy, where the intent was the installation of a government of, quote, public safety, so today we have the Atlantic Monthly revealing in an article by James Mann the Armageddon Plan, developed during the Reagan administration, but actually every administration has had a plan of what would happen if there was a nuclear war and the president couldn't function vice president couldn't function. And the article in the Atlantic Monthly, the Armageddon Plan, details how throughout the presidencies since the Reagan era, two people have been involved time and time again with this clandestine program designed to set aside the legal lines of succession and immediately install a new president. And these people are Dick Cheney, our current vice president, and Donald Rumsfeld, who has been in administration after administration, with starting off as the Secretary of Defense in Gerald Ford's administration.
But, Maya, let's look at this plan, because, after all, it is timed for March 2004 in the Atlantic Monthly. It is labeled the Armageddon Plan by James Mann, and it is associated with the expected nuclear attack. Now, bear in mind that William Safire and Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times, as we cited in the first part of Operation Masquerade, have published articles in the New York Times to state that suitcase nuclear weapons are now in the hands of Osama bin Laden and Zawahiri and Zarqawi, that these are weapons in the hands of a terror apparatus and will be used in New York inevitably. Published in the New York Times, orchestrated again in the Washington Post, and look at how this plays out in the Atlantic Monthly. During the Reagan era, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld were key players in a clandestine program designed to set aside the legal lines of succession and install a new president in the event that there were nuclear attacks upon the country. Once a year during the 1980s, Cheney and Rumsfeld vanished. Cheney was working diligently on Capitol Hill as a congressman rising through the ranks of the Republican leadership. Rumsfeld, who served as General Ford's Secretary of Defense, was a hard-driving business executive The head of G.D. Searle and Company, and I'm quoting, dedicating time and energy to the success of pharmaceutical products, vaccines, NutraSweet, Equal, and Metamucil. We can come back to the implications of the pharmaceutical connection to Cheney and Rumsfeld. They made their way, after leaving their day jobs, to Andrews Air Force Base. From there, in the middle of the night, they were joined by a team of 40 to 60 national security and federal officials, slipped away to a remote location in the United States as a disused military base or underground bunker. They were the principal actors in the most highly classified programs of the Reagan administration, planning exercise for keeping government under their control in the event of chaos or a nuclear attack. Indeed, the inspiration for the program came from the administration itself, and this article, The Armageddon Plan, which details the role of Rumsfeld and Cheney when they were, in the 1980s, relatively minor officials, relatively, not with the prominence they now have, but nonetheless the key figures, along with George H.W. Bush, for a shadow national security government. Their participation in the extra-constitutional continuity of government exercises, remarkable in its own right, demonstrates a broad underlying truth about these men. For three decades, they were in control. They stayed in touch with defense, military, and intelligence officials who called upon them on a regular basis. They were part of the permanent, hidden national security apparatus of the United States, inhabitants of a world in which presidents come and go, but those who control continue. I am quoting from the Armageddon Plan in the March 2004 issue of Atlantic Monthly. Is it not clear what we are confronting here? And what we are confronting as well is the class war, which is moving to an extraordinary and rapid culmination. They were dealt a panic blow in Spain when the masses of the Spanish people revolted against the intended outcome of the terror attacks in Madrid, a blunt instrument they may have had to use in the Social Democratic Party in Spain. But nonetheless, instead of conforming to the expected pattern of bowing and bending the knee to the terror state, they revolted against it. Local 10 of the International Longshore Workers Union has issued what could become a seminal call in the United States for a million worker march on Washington in October of 2004. Independent of the two parties, without any of the politicians invited to speak or participate in this event, it is a mobilization designed to set out a workers' agenda and to challenge the systematic lies of the established order and the all-out assault upon our gains in living standards, the permanent war, the cannibalizing of our infrastructure, a workers' agenda, a way forward, a way out for the mass of our people. That is the class struggle. That is the confrontation that is impending, and that is the reason for Operation Masquerade and the permanent war, the class war, against the mass of humanity by this gangster cabal, the terror state in America.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at takingaim@wbai.org by email or telephone us at 707-552-9995 or write to us by post at Taking Aim, P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, that's V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. Again, our internet site is www.takingaim.info, that's .info, and we have an archive of our programs there. We'll be with you next week. Copies of this program and others are also available on CD and audio cassette. I'm not afraid of the dark.
Tatan sa, kinasaro, tatan sa. Bilang nakmiwalan,